Sorry, I have a bit of hay fever today, so my voice is a bit croaky, but hopefully that doesn't bother people. Chaye Sarah, the life of Sarah. So this is this week's portion, quite a large portion actually, pretty much most of three chapters in Genesis. We are reading through, I think this is actually my first sermon from Genesis this year actually, so I think it is actually, yeah. So there we go. I'm very happy to be teaching from Genesis again. It's such an action-packed, amazing book, the foundation of really biblical faith for Jews and for Christians, no matter if you believe in the New Testament or not. This is really the foundation, the beginning, not only in chronology, but also in, you know, the story and the narrative that we believe in. So last week was also an eventful week, as most of the portions are quite eventful now. So I think Ashley was mentioning last week the three men who came to Abraham and Sarah and promised them a son. And they both actually laughed in doubt, which is why he was called Yitzchak, which comes from the root word of laughter. So Isaac, Yitzchak, laughter. God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah as well, but he let Lot, who is Abraham's nephew, be saved by two of the men. I put men in quotation marks because they were called angels now, as he and his house were deemed the only ones in the whole place worthy of being saved. And if you read more closely, they actually were accused of quite grievous sins, especially sexual sins as well, and a lot of violence. So it was definitely a place that angered God a lot, Sodom and Gomorrah. And I put there in brackets, who was the third man, in quotation marks, because this is actually, I'm not sure if, I can't remember if actually mentioned this much last week, but if you compare Genesis 18 to 19, you've got three men who visit Abraham, and then it says the men had to go down to Sodom, but then the Lord was still staying with Abraham and talking to him. And then in Genesis 19, it says the two angels came to Sodom. So it leads us to sort of think, you know, the third man could have been God. Or I think it was a revelation of God manifest in a man. That's what I think. And I think it's one of many in the Tanakh which has this sort of, I guess, revelation of God in sort of a physical form. But, you know, that was an interesting thing as well. Now, this week, as the parasha sort of implies, the main event is that Sarah dies. So she actually lives to quite an old age. I can't remember exactly how old, I think 127 or something like that. I can't remember actually, but was it 127? Was that right? Oh, good. Oh, that was half a guess. So I couldn't remember exactly off the top of my head, but she dies. And then afterwards, we read about how Abraham purchased the plot of land from the locals over there for Sarah's burial. The majority of the text, though, doesn't deal with this sort of events. It actually deals with Abraham trying to find a wife for his son Isaac. So it's a typical Jewish thing, trying to find, trying to match their children with a particular spouse. So actually, if you look at the text, the majority of the text actually deals with this. So he sends his most trusted servant Eliezer to his homeland to find a wife. And through various signs, for example, the servant asks if the woman who will draw water for me and my camels will be the one who is the one I'm supposed to find. And through those signs being fulfilled, it is Rebecca, or Rivka. And Rebecca and Isaac are eventually married, and Abraham also dies at the end of this passage as well, and he leaves everything to Isaac. So we know that through Abraham leaving everything to Isaac, that Isaac was the one who was to continue the promise of, I guess, the Abrahamic promise, the redemption of the world through his eventual seed, the Messiah. Ishmael is also given some gifts. He doesn't go empty-handed, but he is not given the inheritance. So I just wanted to read from Genesis chapter 24, verses 16 and 22. This is just talking about how it describes Rebekah a bit. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please give me a little water to drink from your jar." She said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking." So this is fulfillment of the sign that he asked God for. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. and she drew for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel. So, this is interesting because, I mean, this is not the first couple that we see in the Tanakh, obviously. We see Adam and Eve, Abraham and Sarah, among others. But this is almost sort of a marriage, not really a marriage ceremony per se, but this is almost like the negotiations for the marriage. He starts giving her things, like a gold ring weighing half a shekel. So this is, we could call this the first marriage which we see the full human effort come to play. So we do see God sort of making Eve for Adam, and we also meet other couples. But the other couples are introduced in the scriptures as, so far, as sort of, you know, after the fact. They're introduced as married. Like, it's Abraham and his wife. It doesn't really go through the wedding, per se, or the way they met. But here we actually sort of go through how Isaac and Rebekah actually eventually come together. So this is the first time this happens in scripture. It's actually quite a romantic thing. Like, you know, like they say the scripture is the source of all, you know, all, you know, storylines. It actually is quite romantic the way we think about, like, you know, the servant asks for a sign. If the woman is right for my master, let this happen. You know, it's a sign. You know, how many people ask for signs? If this girl, this guy is right for me, let this happen. Yeah, it's quite romantic in a way. The woman's very beautiful. It's actually mentioned, this very beautiful woman. And also the servant starts to give her some gifts, like a ring, for example. Yeah, it's amazing because this is like, you know, 75% of like Hollywood love stories, this is how it happens. And this is like, thousands of years ago, this happens. It's amazing. I think it's actually amazing. People haven't changed much in that time. And that last detail about the ring weighing a half shekel, so it seems like sort of a detail which sort of is thrown in there, not that important, but the rabbis actually deduce some amazing lessons about marriage from here. So I'm going to be actually quoting a couple of rabbis for some of the lessons they gave, because I read actually an article this week and it quoted some of these rabbis, and I was actually really blown away by the beautiful lessons they derived from here. And I'm not going to apologize for, you know, quoting, you know, various Jewish rabbis in sermons. I do think that the same way that Lawrence 100 years from now will be quoted, I'm sure, for his amazing sermons, I feel like it is, as long as we hold people to in the right sort of context and the right, you know, we know where they stand, it is perfectly reasonable to draw lessons from great sages and great scholars from before us. So that's what I'm going to do for a lot of this sermon today. So the sages, plural sages, point out the allusion between the half shekel offered by Eliezer to Rebekah, but also the half shekel offering to be given in the temple. So this is from Exodus 30, verses 11 to 15. The Lord said to Moses, "When you take the census of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there will be no plague among them when you number them. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give this half a shekel, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs, half a shekel as an offering to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upwards shall give the Lord's offering. The rich shall give no more, and the poor shall give no less than a half shekel when you give the Lord's offering to make atonement for your lives." And the reason why it's almost given as a ransom is because for some reason, God doesn't really like censuses too much. He actually punishes the Israelites for undertaking a census which he didn't actually command, and actually suffered from a plague. So this is actually, when it says a ransom for his life, that's the sort of literal meaning. But also, it can be interpreted to mean, like, you know, there's a price in everyone's life, and God sort of, I mean, not really a way of providing atonement in the same way of sacrifices do, but it's sort of along the same lines as well. Now, I wanted to talk about what Maimonides, so Rambam, I've quoted him many, many times, even though I don't agree with a lot of what he says, but he was still an amazing man in so many ways. He actually talked a lot about this, and he actually writes this really beautiful sort of guideline, in a way, of how to actually give, you know, give something to God. Maimonides writes, I'm quoting now from that particular source if you want to read it online, "Everything that is for the sake of God should be the best and most beautiful. When one builds a house of prayer, it should be more beautiful than his own dwelling. When one feeds the hungry, he should feed him of the best and sweetest of his table." I'm skipping along. "When one designates something for a holy purpose, he should sanctify the finest of his possessions, as it is written, all fat is the Lord's." That's from Leviticus chapter 3. And in this context, it's sort of a metaphorical meaning given to this. The fat of the Lord's actually talks about sacrifices, but it's sort of, he's drawing a metaphorical meaning, like, you know, everything is God's, like all good things are God's or from God. So like it's sort of a metaphorical, so the rabbis did this quite a lot to find metaphorical meanings from the text. But it is, I think, a beautiful lesson. So the question is, if we are supposed to contribute to God our very best, why is the temple tax only half a shekel? So I guess because half a shekel doesn't seem like it's the full, you know, the full amount that people could give. Why not a whole shekel? Why not 2, 5, 10? Why only half a shekel? Doesn't this disrespect the things of God? So that's a question which I think the answer to this question could come back to teach us about marriage itself. So again, I'm not saying this is the answer, like it's only my answer. I always, you know, want to preface this, it's my answer, but I think there is actually a lesson here which could teach us a lot about marriage itself. Now, what I'm about to talk about is actually from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. So I know he's very unpopular here in the Messianic circles because of his various, the Messianic, I guess, fervor surrounding him. I'm not endorsing the Lubavitcher Rebbe. In the same way that when Lawrence talked about Martin Luther last week, he wasn't endorsing Martin Luther. So I feel, again, I'm not apologizing for quoting this from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because it's actually a really beautiful thing he said to, he actually said this sermon to a group of women, Jewish women, in 1984. And he sort of draws from various Jewish traditions to actually really give a beautiful lesson about the half shekel. So I'm going to quote some of his sermon. So the Zohar explains, man and woman comprising of two halves of a single body, likewise share a single soul. The Torah assigns different roles to men and women. Obviously, this does not imply the superiority or inferiority of either sex, only that in addition to their common mission in life, each has its unique function and role in creation. This can be compared to the human body, which is comprised of various limbs and organs. On the one hand, there are the needs and features that are common to each of the body cells. On the other hand, each organ and limb has its distinct needs and features that derive of its specific role within the greater function of the body. It is only that God desired that for a certain portion of its life on earth, the soul should be divided in two, half of it in a male body and its other half in a female body, and that each half should perform its mission in life separately until such time that God unites them in marriage. This explains the tremendous joy that accompanies a marriage, a joy that has no parallel in any other joyful occasion. For when two half-souls separated at birth and raised in different homes, different communities, perhaps even different countries, are reunited by the power of He who sits and matches couples. Now, that quote is actually not from the scripture, obviously. It's actually from a Jewish legend, the Midrash. So that's where the quote is from. What greater joy can there be? And that's the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He also does go on to say, which I didn't quote here, that even, you know, he mentions like people who remain single throughout their whole life, and he actually, he doesn't say that that is a particularly worse path for people. He just sort of says that in that situation, a person would still have the other half of their soul in another man, but they fulfill their purpose in life through, through their soul as best as they can. And he doesn't actually say that's necessarily a worse thing than marriage, but he sort of describes the joy of marriage as in such a powerful way, but two halves coming together. And in that way, we sort of learn, again, the article goes on to say that from the half shekel, the reason why, in his view, why the half shekel was actually the offering and not a full shekel was to teach us about the two half souls coming together in marriage. That was, his idea of the reason behind that. And look, I think it's actually quite a beautiful lesson, to be honest. Like, it goes to show how when things are not fully complete in themselves, when they're joined to something else, they can become, greater than some of their parts in a really beautiful union. So I really, and I love that he says this, like he was saying this to women, not to men. He was actually talking to women. And I think he actually, one of the things that he did actually, more so than other Orthodox rabbis, was he really empowered women to take an active role in Jewish life, not so much to sit in the back, sit in the back and sort of just support the men, but he actually really encouraged women to really take an active role. So that's something good that he did, and you know, I think we should respect him for the good things he did do as well. Now, I think this idea, though, is actually expressed in Jesus' words as well in the New Testament, in Matthew and in Mark, but I'm quoting the Mark portion. But from the beginning of creation, God created the male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and vice versa, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So I think when we think about the souls joining together, it actually gives these words so much more power, because it ceases to be just a physical union, it becomes a union of souls. And people sort of, may be tempted to ask, why is Jesus so Yeshua so harsh on divorce? Why is he called adultery when people divorce? Why is he so against it? But maybe the reason why he was so against it is because there's some sort of underlying, almost hidden truth. It's not just a physical union, but the two become one flesh. But the two half souls become one soul. And therefore, if God does this, let no man separate them. It really gives it, I think, a bit more power when you think of it in this way as well. So I wanted to sort of bring that context to the gospel, Jesus' discussion of marriage in the Gospels as well. So we'll stop there. Thank you very much, guys. Let's please rise. I will say this prayer together, and then we'll finish our service with the last few songs. Blessed are you, O Lord our God.